Do you ever get the feeling like someone is watching you? Katie Chubb knows exactly what that's like.
I was pulling out of my neighborhood and I was like, man, am I getting a new neighbor? And I'm looking, I'm like, it's a really nice black truck. And I'm like, it's a really nice black truck. All the windows are blacked out, like completely. And I went to Kroger and I noticed they were getting in the car almost the same time as me heading back. And then there's the same car the next day. And I was like, this is weird. Like, and that's when I was just like, this is not normal.
That same truck would show up again and again, several days in a row.
I didn't want to approach them because this is Georgia and I'm a female and I had a kid with me. So I just kind of was like, you know what? Enjoy your time with me in Kroger, because that's all we're going to today. We're going to sit in the house.
When Katie first noticed that truck, it was not long after she had filed a lawsuit challenging some state regulations that had blocked her from opening a birth center in Augusta, Georgia. State regulations that protect hospitals from unwanted competition. Maybe she was just being paranoid. Maybe this had nothing to do with that. Or maybe not. You're listening to a Reason Magazine podcast series about how the free market could keep Americans healthy and well cared for if only the government didn't get in the way. On last week's episode, we introduced you to Katie Chubb and Jay Singleton. Katie is an entrepreneur in Georgia. Singleton is an eye doctor in North Carolina. Both had tried to open new healthcare facilities and both ran smack into a series of anti-competitive government regulations called Certificate of Need laws, which are on the books in one form or another in many states. If you missed last week's episode, this is a good time to pull a U-turn and go check it out. If you don't want to do that, however, we'll try our best to catch you up here. When we left off with Katie, she had just learned that the state had denied her Certificate of Need application for the birth center that she hoped to open. The bureaucrats acknowledged that she had a credentialed staff, a solid business plan, and that her center would fill a pressing need for additional maternity care in eastern Georgia. But she also needed at least one local hospital to sign off on that proposal, and none of them would.
We're not going to give up. And we have all the credentialing and all the right. You showed that this was needed, but yet you still denied us because you allowed the hospitals as a business to oppose us. So you're saying that a McDonald's can't open next to a Burger King is what you're essentially saying, is you can't have two competing businesses in the healthcare market.
Meanwhile, Jay had been showing me around his fully outfitted surgical clinic that he'd built adjacent to his eye clinic in North Carolina. Thanks to some, frankly, weird nuances in North Carolina's Certificate of Need rules, he's allowed to do some surgeries here, but not others. For those, he has to use the hospital down the road, where it is more difficult to schedule those surgeries and more expensive, too.
There are people waiting 9 months for cataract surgery, and by the time I see them, I mean, they've had car accidents. You have people waiting forever on a five-minute surgery that could change their life. So access is a huge one.
So on this week's episode, we'll pick up Jay's and Katie's stories as they diverge. She'll take her fight to the state legislature in Georgia, and he will head to the courts in North Carolina. While we're following those stories, we'll also take a deeper look at some of the perverse incentives created by Certificate of Need laws, which are, in healthcare at least, one of the big reasons why we can't have nice things. I'm Eric Bame. When Katie first noticed that black truck that seemed to be following her around town, she wasn't really sure what to make of it. And then she mentioned it to her attorney.
I think they were wanting to catch me doing some kind of something business crime related. And I was like, oh, we're really not that fun. I'm sorry. But I confirmed with my attorney and I said, hey, I think I'm being followed. And he said, oh, yeah, absolutely. They probably did that. And he's an ex-hospital attorney. And he said, this is not uncommon. And he's like, thank God you guys are boring. They paid someone to check you out because they didn't know who they were up against. They didn't know if you were a lawyer. They saw you were an entrepreneur and figured you'd bail after they denied you.
Do you think it was an intimidation tactic at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was an intimidation tactic. But I had parents that grew up in Northern Ireland in the Troubles. I'm not scared of a little confrontation, a little fight. They can bring it on. I've done 20 years in martial arts and I work at, you know, my other company is exercise physiology. So at least I can outrun them mentally and physically.
Katie was not about to back down from the fight. In fact, after getting rejected because of Georgia's Certificate of Need requirements, Katie went on the offensive. She organized social media campaigns. She got in touch with state lawmakers, and she reached out to nonprofits like Stand Together and the Pacific Legal Foundation, both of which have pushed for con reform in a variety of states.
We call it in Augusta the good old boy system, and it's the good old boys talking to each other. But the sad part is the good old boys club does not know technology, and it does not know how to use TikTok and Facebook, and they're just not caught up with the time. So every disadvantage that we could think of that they would be using against us, we just flipped the coins. They thought that I was going to drop this fight immediately after getting declined, and they didn't see this coming, and they were very, very shocked.
By 2023, Katie's efforts were starting to pay off. In August, she testified before a Georgia State House committee that was studying potential changes to the state's con laws.
Morning, everybody. Good to be here. Want to call our meeting to order and welcome everyone to the second meeting of the Georgia House Study Committee on Certificate of Need Modernization. Next on our agenda, Katie Chubb.
Good morning, Chairman, representatives, doctors, nurses, and supporters of the Augusta Birth Center who could be here today. Thank you for coming. Every day, I receive 3 inquiries on my social media account from women who need services. But guess what? We're not open. I can't do anything. I can't send them anywhere. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak, and I welcome any questions. You can be as fiery as you want. You can come for me. That's totally fine, because nothing is going to compare to the heat I was put under preparing 826 pages. I'm here to represent the future of women in this area, and I'm not going to back down, so give me everything you've got.
A few months later, she testified in front of a state Senate study committee, which helps to prepare lawmakers for issues that could come up during the following year's legislative session.
It was a great moment. It was fantastic. There were a lot of senators who were very interested in, people in the Senate study committee who were very interested in why we were denied. And there were other businesses there, like one of our volunteers and supporters is trying to open a radiation center here in Augusta. And that is badly needed as well. And he's also been denied.
So that was really a turning point.
Yeah, that was by far the moment we blew the case in. We got so much more press that day. They did a lot of interviews and statements that day. It was incredible.
She also learned that she wasn't the only victim. At least 7 different medical facilities had been denied certificate of need licenses in Georgia between 2019 and 2021, the same time period when Katie had been putting together her business plan. That included a new radiation therapy center to treat cancer patients in Canton, Georgia, a bit north of Atlanta, and a freestanding surgical center in Braselton. It also included 2 neonatal intensive care units, and if you listened to part 1 of this story last week, I don't have to remind you why it's a terrible idea to tell hospitals they can't build more of those. Thanks in no small part to Katie's efforts, when the new legislative session opened in early 2024, certificate of need reform was on the agenda in Georgia. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, Eye Dr. Jay Singleton's fight to open his surgical clinic has also been progressing, and it's now reached the highest court in the state. But it's been a long journey.
This equipment couldn't have been cheap, I imagine. How much did you invest in this space?
The whole space? You know, I did this 7 years ago before all the building craze went up, but I still spent about $1.1 million just to build this out. It's very expensive. We always have to have backups. These are all Alcon machines that we use here. And they're very nice machines, but they're very expensive. All of our plastics instrumentation is extremely expensive. It's titanium. So, you know, we spend a lot of money here. I'm biased, but they look better than the outpatient surgery centers. And so, you know, we'll see. Every 2 weeks, we'll do a half a day and do about 12 or 13 cataracts, as opposed to the hospital where every week I do probably 60 cataracts a week. And, you know, I do maybe 26 cataracts a month here because of the fact that, as we just spoke about earlier, you know, cataracts occur in older patients, and older patients are usually on Medicare, which automatically puts them in that surgery center in this state.
Does that make sense? No. Is it more expensive? Oh, yeah. According to the lawsuit that Jay filed against the state, a surgery that he could do for $1,800 in his clinic instead costs about $6,000 at the hospital down the road. And like Katie, Jay has a very clear memory of the moment when he realized this was not just some silly little detail that could be easily ignored or changed.
Former CEO of the hospital, I thought, you know, I kind of knew him, you know. And I went and talked to him just privately. And I went to his office and said, look, I was just thinking about building a surgery center. I mean, my surgeries are 5-minute surgeries. I'm trying to be logical. that are done under topical anesthesia. I don't really need you guys. I said, you know, trust me, I've had, at that point, I've had two babies here. They were not born at home. You know, I utilize your hospital myself. So I'd like to have your permission to not come, you know, not confront me or not to basically oppose me at with a certificate of need. And he stood up and stared at me and hit his hands on the table. And he said, Wilk, we're going to fight you on this. And I just thought, man, you know, I was trying to be really peaceful. You know, I said, but I'm trying to tell you that I really don't need your hospital. I'm being forced to use it. And I'd like to stop doing that. But that was a big turning point for me when I just realized that I realized the ferocity of the response.
So with the easy way apparently closed off, Jay tried to get the law changed the old-fashioned way. He went to talk to state lawmakers.
I went to my General Assembly, and I went there, and I thought, well, you know, I'm a citizen. So I started talking about CON and why it shouldn't be around. I knew that it was kind of a hot-button topic. And they told me, they called me back and said, well, you know, he needs a lobbyist. I thought, no. We would go up there and we would talk, and we would catch the legislators in the hallway, you know, what between coffee breaks, and they would kind of be like, oh, you don't want to talk to you, you know, and you wait outside their office. Sometimes they would never come out. And, you know, every now and then I got to talk to somebody about it. But my point is, I was trying to, I made the change on good faith.
When that approach didn't work either, Jay tried a different tactic. He got connected with Josh Windham, who we met in last week's episode. He's an attorney with the Institute for Justice, and he recently argued Jay's case before the North Carolina Supreme Court. When they met each other, Josh was in a bit of a tough spot, too. He'd already been litigating against North Carolina's Certificate of Need laws for a few years, representing a different doctor who had been unable to obtain a CON for a new MRI machine.
Singh began leasing an MRI machine and charging patients $500 per scan. He added a flat-fee surgical clinic with the hope that others would sprout up, increasing competition and driving down healthcare costs. But leasing an MRI was expensive, $1.5 million when it was all said and done. Singh needed to buy one outright. But he says North Carolina law that regulates medical equipment purchases was in the way.
We live in America. It's a free country. You know, if you got a four pizza shop, you want to open another one, nobody says you can't open it. You got money, you want to open a pizza shop, you can do it. But we don't do that in healthcare because the competition has been taken away.
The law is called Certificate of Need, or CON.
In 2018, we filed a lawsuit on behalf of Dr. Singh. He wanted to open an imaging center, and his vision for the imaging center was that he would provide transparent pricing, as low prices as he possibly can for things like MRI scans, CAT scans, x-rays, echocardiograms, you know, the works, right? All the types of scans and imaging you would have ordered by a doctor for various purposes, including himself, because he's a physician or a surgeon. And so he's like, look, patients need access to these things when I order them, right? Not just me, but other surgeons too. And so he saw a real need. He tried to meet it by opening this imaging center. And there had been no need determination for an MRI scanner in his area for, you know, well over a decade, if not longer. We litigated on behalf of Dr. Singh for a couple of years. We filed a lawsuit under the North Carolina Constitution alleging that the CON requirement for MRI scanners, especially when there's been no need determination for, you know, over a decade or more, violated various parts of the state constitution, including the state's anti-monopoly clause.
Josh litigated that case for several years, but it ended in disappointment when Dr. Singh went out of business during the pandemic.
We had to voluntarily dismiss it. And a few months later, we refiled basically the same lawsuit on behalf of Dr. Jay Singleton.
Second time's the charm, right? But getting that question back in front of the state Supreme Court has been a lengthy process. Josh has now been litigating Jay's case for 4 years, and it was only in April that he finally got to the state's highest court. And it's still not at a point where the court will actually consider the merits or the constitutional questions in the case. He's still trying to prove that Jay has the right to bring this constitutional challenge in the first place because of some of the weird wrinkles in North Carolina's Certificate of Need law.
The formal legal term for this is exhaust his administrative remedies. But the basic idea behind that is that courts don't really have jurisdiction to hear these kinds of constitutional questions in challenges to statutes unless a plaintiff has first tried to go through the administrative process that the statute establishes. And the kind of idea behind that is that you don't really know you're injured unless the government has told you we're going to deny you a CON. And the problem with that argument here is that Dr. Singleton had no way to apply for a CON. right?
So he can't apply for a CON because the state's health regulators have refused to accept applications for new surgical centers in the region of the state where Jay lives. And the bureaucrats have decided that since there's no need, he can't apply. And if he can't apply, then he also can't seek a legal remedy for being denied.
I mean, think of it this way. When government agencies have new rules that they want to, you know, create regulations, there's something called notice and comment, right? And really, it's an argument that Dr. Singleton has to go through a notice and comment process, that he has to file his, you know, send them a letter asking them, pretty please change your mind, before he can bring a constitutional challenge to the underlying requirement that he get a permission slip in the first place. It doesn't make any sense.
There's a cronyist element, obviously, inherent to some of this with the con laws, the way these things are written. You've talked about this. There's lobbying. There's influence by hospitals on this. But even if there weren't, even if you took that completely out of the equation, the bureaucrats would still be wrong about things sometimes.
I think they're wrong all the time. Because anytime they decide that somebody who can provide quality services can't enter a market because they perceive there isn't a need for it, they're making a choice based on hubris, right? Not based on science or logic or anything else, because again, need is a function of what people want, right? I mean, just to kind of like wax about this for a second,
please.
The thing that really irks me about con laws, you often get a response from the other side, whether you're talking about the government or entrenched healthcare interests that really want these laws to stay on the books. You often get a response that says, these are complex, scientific, rigorously considered laws that apply mathematical formulas based on market data. And so they try to make these laws sound really scientific and in a sense, rational.
Are they?
They're not. And part of how you know a law isn't rational is that it prevents good people from doing good things, right? Dr. Singleton is a good person. He's qualified to provide these services. Everybody agrees they're safe. Everybody agrees that they're more affordable than the hospital 2 miles down the road. Everybody agrees that there are patients who would benefit from getting those services. The only thing people don't agree about is whether he should be allowed to compete on the market. And I think that's plainly irrational, right? It hurts the person you're trying to help. And so it doesn't make any sense to say patients in the Craven-Jones-Pamlico area don't deserve the choice of more affordable services in a safe facility. And preventing them from getting those services is itself harmful to them. Laws that hurt people are irrational.
I keep thinking back to something that Matt Mitchell said in last week's episode. We talked about how con laws were originally mandated by Congress, and then the mandate was quickly repealed when it became obvious that they had been a mistake, that they were not working as intended. That all happened back in the 1980s. So how do we explain the persistence of these rules 40 years later? Mitchell has spent years researching con laws, so I asked him to explain.
What's going on here? Because, are the regulators just really bad at deciding what need is or where the needs are? Like, are they just failing at their job?
That could be some of it. I think it's probably less, I'm less inclined to blame the regulators as, you know, necessarily bad folks. I suspect they're trying to do their job. I think that the problem is really that it's just sort of baked into the process. So there's a number of things, you know, that make it anti-competitive. So for one, most regulations and most statutes say that a con has to be denied if it can be shown that it will duplicate an existing service. Well, that language of duplication is really what you and I would call competition. So it essentially, you know, guarantees a local monopoly. So if they're doing their job, they sort of have to deny care, or at least deny competitive care. Another anti-competitive feature, though, that's really prominent is that all but 6 certificate of need states allow incumbent providers to be a part of the process. So even if they're not sitting on the board, they are allowed to object to a competitor's application. And so they wait that. And now here's where, you know, public choice comes in. The folks that are, you know, most have most at stake here are the would-be competitors, and they're very well organized, and they know how to object to a con law, and they're gonna file an objection.
This is basically, to use a jargony term, this is a public choice theory critique of what's happening here with con laws. So can you basically explain what that term is and why it matters?
Yeah, public choice is the branch of economics, or it's a field of study within economics that basically applies many of the tools of economic analysis to politics. So in the same way that an economist might look at a market and see how, you know, a service is supplied or demanded. A public choice economist looks at the market for legislation or for regulations and looks at what's the supply or demand of votes, what's the supply or demand of regulations. And one of the, you know, chief lessons of public choice is that small, concentrated, and highly organized interest groups wield outsized power over large, diffuse, unorganized interest groups. And often what this means is it leads to policy that's either inefficient or, you know, grossly inequitable, because it means that the organized group is able to foist costs on the unorganized group to their benefit. And so I think certificate of need law is perhaps one of the better illustrations of that, this dynamic.
What are the special interests when it comes to con laws that are so organized and focused?
So in every state, there is a hospital association. And in just about every state, the hospital association is interested in either maintaining con or perhaps getting it. For the most part, it's large hospitals, university-affiliated hospitals often. Hospitals with the biggest endowments are the ones that generally favor it. And the reason is they, being politically active, having a fair amount of capital allows them to be able to do what it takes. They know the con process cold. They know how to obtain a con. And even though it may raise some of their costs in order to obtain this, it's a greater, it raises the cost of their rivals more. And so it's a way to corner the market. Those who have stand to lose, the patients, typically don't even know these rules exist. Providers who are, you know, new entrant providers, they're typically not very well organized politically. So that stacks the deck against competition.
It's that same public choice dynamic that shows up when, for example, the hospitals in Augusta, Georgia, tried to block Katie's plan for opening a birth center. It also explains what happened when the hospital executive pounded his hands on the desk and told Jay they were going to fight him over the surgical center. But those special interests can be beaten.
And it's, this whole journey has not only just been about con, it's been about showing people that you can defeat these industries.
Katie's story ends with a victory. After a few years of organizing support online, giving testimony to state legislative committees, and partnering with free market nonprofits, Katie got to watch earlier this year as lawmakers in Georgia passed a major con reform bill that Governor Brian Kemp signed.
You know, as I laid out in my state of state address back in January, improving access and quality of health care for hardworking Georgians has been a top priority since I have taken office.
That's Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, speaking at the bill signing ceremony in April.
We are proud of the progress that we have made, but we also know that we still have a lot of work to do to ensure all Georgians have access to quality, reliable health care. And the good news is today we are taking many steps forward in ensuring that reality. Now Georgians will have greater access to several important areas of health care: basic prenatal services, birthing centers, general acute hospitals, and much more. With that, let's start signing some bills. Thank you all for being here.
As Kemp explains in that clip, the bill creates some new exemptions for certain types of health care, but it doesn't repeal all of Georgia's con laws. It means that some people, like Katie, won't have to go through the con labyrinth in order to open a new birthing center or a new psychiatric care facility. That's not ideal, because it means that a lot of other medical practices are still stuck with that same protectionist, irrational process. But this is undeniably a step in the right direction.
When I first started the birth center, I interviewed with a very smart man from the Augusta Chronicle called Thomas Colwin. He's been a health reporter for many years. And he said, this is a game of chess, Katie. He said, I don't know if you know what you're getting into. And I said, oh, good thing for me is I love chess and I love a challenge. And this, I just actually messaged him on Sunday and I said, hey, this is what happened and this is the outcome. And it's been incredible to see the shift and change in the community here, to seeing despair, to seeing hope.
Katie still has a lot of work ahead of her. The con process held up her birth center for so long that she ended up not being able to purchase the parcel of land in Augusta where she'd originally planned to build it. So she's now pursuing a slightly modified business plan, more on the outskirts of the city. But as you can tell, she's a cheerful and optimistic person, and she's already keen to talk about other changes that she hopes to persuade Georgia lawmakers to make in next year's legislative session.
I know there's a couple other birth centers that are wanting to start up in closer around the Atlanta area. And I think it's a good thing that we've got this through. I think there's a little bit more work we need to do. I think we need to get full practice rights for nurse midwives. I think we need that to solve part of the maternal mortality problem. But I think kicking off the birth center con case was the way that we moved through this and continue on with momentum to continue to get more regulations changed. Definitely propelled me forward and made me realize that even the smallest person in somewhere remote as Augusta can start some changes and get some things made better.
For Jay, the long fight to change North Carolina's con laws is still ongoing, even after getting his case in front of the highest court in the state.
My oldest daughter, who is unimpressed by everything all the time, she's like, oh, it's not the actual Supreme Court, Dad. I was like, no, it's not. And she was like, well, you know, call me when that happens.
Yeah. Hopefully that won't be necessary. For now, Jay and his attorney, Josh, are still waiting for the state Supreme Court to rule. If they win this round, they'll be able to go back down to the lower courts and actually argue the merits of the case, actually force the judges to look at the constitutionality of this rule that creates healthcare monopolies. So I asked Jay to sum up how he's feeling at this point after 4 years of being in this fight, knowing that there could be a lot more to come.
Hopeful. And slow. So those are my two words to sum up this entire battle. One more word would be exhausting. I'm just hopeful for change, because if I think any other way, I could start to slowly lose faith in the foundations upon which the country's built, because this is a slam dunk. And you know, if it's not taken care of soon, I'll just wonder if anything can be changed.
It's the efforts of people like Jay and Josh and Katie that have started to turn the tide on certificate of need laws. South Carolina enacted sweeping con reforms last year, and several other state legislatures have been working on similar bills. Look, this is not the sexiest political issue. It's not going to be front page news in most places. In part, I think that's because it's so difficult to see the consequences of certificate of need laws. You don't see the hospitals that aren't built, the NICUs that don't exist, the MRI machines and the surgical centers that would have been there if state regulators didn't get in the way.
I think that's right. And it's also the case that con laws kind of box healthcare markets in. They sort of preserve them in amber where they're at. So the reason I say that is that, the con laws create categories of services or facilities that you can open and then require you to get a con to do those things, right? And so if somebody who wants to enter the healthcare industry one day, an aspiring entrepreneur or a physician who wants to provide new services, starts to get a sense of what the law allows and requires, they'll look at that list and start to box themselves into the preordained categories the government has set. And that's a problem because forecloses the kind of innovative thinking, the kind of outside-the-box thinking that drives markets forward in all their contexts.
And it also makes me wonder what innovations in other parts of the modern world wouldn't exist if they had been subject to regulations like certificate of need laws.
I mean, they're really permission slip requirements for innovators, right? And the basic premise is that the government is in a position to know whether new services are needed or not. And that's silly for a number of reasons. The government can't possibly know these things in advance, in part because people's perceptions of their own needs will change, but also because the facts of reality will change. It's also true that technology changes, right? So how can the government possibly know if a new service that hasn't been invented yet is needed? I mean, think of Steve Jobs, right? We didn't know we needed the iPhone until Steve Jobs told us we needed the iPhone, until he showed us an iPhone existed. Here's what it can do for you. And we all decided in response to that, you know what? I do need that, because need is ultimately a function of what people perceive they want in their lives, right? What they choose to value. And they can't know they value something until they've seen it, right? And so just the idea that the government can decide ex ante or in a vacuum or sitting in an office together using mathematical formulas whether services are needed in the future, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, right? It doesn't reflect the reality of how markets work, of how innovation works, of how, human well-being works.
I'm Eric Boehm, and you've been listening to the second season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things. Big special thanks to my guests on this stuffed two-part episode about the problems with Certificate of Need laws, especially to Kitty Chubb and Dr. Jay Singleton. Thank you so much for sharing your personal stories. Josh Windham, who you heard at the very end there, he's an attorney with the Institute for Justice. You can follow the latest developments in his case on behalf of Jay Singleton and check out everything else that IJ does. Lots of fine work on Certificate of Need laws and other economic liberty issues. You can find all that at IJ.org. Check out Matt Mitchell's work on con laws at Mercatus.org. We're now halfway through the new season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, but I'm so excited for you to hear next week's episode, which we're calling The Case of the 17,000 Missing Kidneys. There are tens of thousands of Americans waiting for a kidney transplant that could save or dramatically improve their lives. Unfortunately, a series of monopolistic government contractors are not doing a good job of making sure that donated organs get where they need to go.
But how wild is it in a life and death issue that's costing 33 American lives every single day that the taxpayer funds that we'd be funding this kind of deadly failure?
Tune in next Thursday to hear more about that. Today's episode was written by Eric Boehm and produced by Hunt Beatty, fact-checking by Anthony Wallace. Our executive editor at Reason is Jim Epstein. Thanks for listening, and please check out the rest of Reason's podcasts, including the rest of this series, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, available wherever you get your pods.